Welcome to Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman, serial entrepreneur, author, and podcast host. Whether success for you is more money, time with your family, a healthy, well-balanced life, or freedom, I'm interviewing guests and getting you the advice to make it happen. So join me as we uncomplicate the complicated, help you define success, and give you the strategies to make it happen. Hello and welcome to Success Is Podcast, where we dive into the journeys of incredible individuals who have excelled in various fields and share their stories of success, perseverance, and purpose. I'm your host, Phil Portman, and today we have an absolutely remarkable guest with us, Anne Montgomery. Anne has had a remarkable career starting as a television sportscaster. She broke barriers as a woman in sports media, working for ESPN and hosting the Phoenix Sun studio show. She's also a published author, journalist, teacher, and sports official. Beyond her professional life, Anne is a foster mom and enjoys hobbies like rock collecting, scuba diving, theater, and playing guitar. Her multifaceted journey promises a unique perspective on success. Anne, welcome to the Success Is Podcast. It's an honor to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Phil. I'm glad to be joining you today.
So as we always begin, Anne, what does success mean to you?
I've thought a great deal about this lately, and I think it's very simple. Dying with great stories.
That's a great answer.
You know, I think that sometimes now I'm going to be 70 next year. That's a big one. And I realize that some people my age seem to be a little bitter sometimes. And I'm thinking mostly it's because they didn't do a lot of the things they wanted to do. So to me, it's you die with great stories.
I love that. And you have, it sounds like, created some great stories. You've written some great stories. But I want to talk about your career. You've had this incredible career spanning television, writing, teaching, sports officiating. What was your first major break in broadcasting, and how did it shape your career moving forward?
Well, you have to remember, I when I wanted to first be a sportscaster, it was the 1972. I was in high school. There weren't any women that did that kind of thing. I was clearly out of my mind, as my mother kept pointing out. When she said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be a sportscaster. And she said, don't be ridiculous. I'm trying to have a serious conversation with you. And so that was pretty much the way it was all through college. There simply weren't women that actually did that. You know, it'd be one thing if you're Peggy Fleming and you're talking about ice skating in the Olympic years. But women weren't covering football or basketball or ice hockey or any of those sports. So I couldn't get a job. I couldn't get an interview. No one would even talk to me. I couldn't fill out a form. So, you know how sometimes in life, funny little things happen that change everything. And for me, that was a Washington Capitals hockey game. I went to a game with my aunt, who was more like a sister to me. She brought a friend, and he was an amateur ice hockey official. And I mean, he officiated for kids. And we're watching this horrible hockey game, as the Capitals were pretty bad. And he was bemoaning the fact that there weren't enough officials. And my aunt goes, oh, Annie can skate. Because I was an ice dancer growing up, a terrible one, but I was one. And I said, yeah, I can skate. And he goes, well, why don't you be a hockey referee? And I went, great. And it was funny because my first game was a disaster. I'd never been in hockey skates before. I spent my life in figure skates. And I didn't understand. Did you know the big difference between hockey skates and figure skates, Phil?
Is it the way you stop or?
No.
That's a good question.
It's the blades, the edge of the blade, the toe pick of the blade. And on figure skates, we have these sharp toe picks. Hockey skates are rounded, right? So I didn't know. It didn't occur to me. And I was working in a bar in Georgetown. I'd have like 3 hours sleep before I got to my first hockey game. And it was five-year-old kids. Have you ever seen little tiny hockey players? They're hysterical. They have like jerseys down to their ankles and their helmets are all too big and falling rakishly to the sides, and their sticks are all sawed off. And I went out to take my first face off when 3 hours sleep. It was 6 a.m. and I fell because I'm used to being a lazy skater leaning on those toe picks. And I fell on the ice and I dug my skate in just reflexively to get back up, and I fell again. And so these five-year-olds are staring down at me like, what's wrong with the ref? And it took me three times, got up. I don't remember a single thing about the rest of the game, but I do recall realizing that I didn't know enough to be a sportscaster. I grew up before Title IX. I was a skater and I swam not just for fun, you know, and I was a skier, but I wasn't that good. So I'd never been on a team. I didn't, you know, we didn't have that many opportunities back then. So I realized that I didn't know enough. And I decided to take 5 years of my life and become a certified amateur official in football, baseball, ice hockey, soccer, and basketball. And I would work in this bar in Georgetown, which in the 80s was great fun, I must say. And that's what I did. I worked at the restaurant. I officiated games. I became certified in those sports. And I believed in my heart that somewhere in the country, there was a forward-thinking news director who would go, oh, that girl must know what she's talking about because she's an umpire and a referee. And that's exactly what happened. So I became an official so I could learn the game so I could convince somebody to hire me. And I went on to work for 5 TV stations, including ESPN, where I anchored SportsCenter. But the ironic thing is I never quit officiating until 2019. I called my last high school football game 5 years ago. And I officiated for 40 years. And today I don't miss TV. I don't miss teaching because I spent 20 years teaching, but I miss Friday night football. Now, I don't know if I answered your question or not.
You absolutely did. But I'd like to expand on it a little bit and say, you know, what kind of advice would you give for women who are trying to break into a male-dominated field like you did with sports and broadcasting?
Have a thick skin. People are going to behave in ways that you don't especially like sometimes. I've had people not be very nice to me, certainly as an official. I mean, when I first became an official, I thought they were mean to me because I was a girl. It was no, because I was wearing the uniform. You know, when you show up with your chest protector and your shin guards at a baseball game, they hate you automatically, or stripes at a football game or a soccer game. So the bottom line is you have to be willing to not get upset, not take everything personally when people are not very nice. And in both sports broadcasting in my time, I mean, I worked in the 80s and 90s. They're just, you know, there weren't many women doing those kinds of things back then. And officiating, same way. Mm-hmm. Don't take things personally. Learn from the criticism you receive, because a lot of times everybody gets upset. Oh, they're criticizing me. Well, why are they criticizing you? Did you learn? Did you do something wrong? Can you do it better next time? So to me, take criticism as a gift. They care enough to tell you that you're not maybe doing a great job. Admit you're not doing a great job and learn from it. And, you know, try to have every day, try to find something that you enjoyed in your job.
Yes. Yeah, so I wonder if that intense criticism and that formed a tough skin that maybe that helped you out later in life. I found that one of my early jobs was door-to-door sales.
Oh, gosh.
You know what I mean? Horrible. Getting slammed in the face, you know, door slammed in the face and getting, you know, get out of here and that kind of thing. Built the tough skin that, like, later on really helped me. Because it's like, well, I've seen
I really think it does because, you know, I worry sometimes about younger people, and I probably shouldn't say this because I have got kids in their 20s. But people are so sensitive. You know, we have a problem with officials. We don't have enough officials anymore. I mean, my last 10 years officiating, I'd go and there wouldn't be a full complement of football officials, or I might be calling a baseball game all by myself. That's hard to do because the average new official quits in 3 years. They can't handle the abuse. Now, I'm not saying we should be abused. And certainly today with the internet, used to be I make a bad call on a Friday night or my crew makes a bad call. It's over. I go home. You know, I might need a police escort to my car, which I've had more than once. But the bottom line is I go home and it's over. Now, it's not over today because today they put it on the internet. Today they put your name on the internet. They put the call on the internet. And it's very hard. It is very hard to get past that. Yeah. So, but we're not going to have officials. And if people have kids that are playing sports, I have one request. If your child plays a sport, I want you to officiate one game once. Go out there. You give that a shot. You know, we don't have 9 cameras giving us all kind of angles on it. I get one look. Is it interference? I don't, you know, was the quarterback's arm going forward? Well, I'll do the best I can on that. Am I always right? No. Do I want to always be right? Yes, I do. So anybody that says officials are doing it on purpose are out of their minds. We get observed. We get graded. You know, we get better games depending on how well we're graded. Nobody wants to make a mistake. But we do. And again, we need to learn from those things and not get all upset every time someone says we didn't do the right thing.
Absolutely. That's part of the game, that human element. That's part of the game.
It won't be for long. I'm pretty sure officials are one of the first jobs that's going to vanish with AI and technology. And I think when the last game, the last sport gets rid of the officials, that fans are going to miss us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they're not going to have anybody yell at or anybody to blame.
Right. That's right.
No, I really think they'll feel bad about that.
Yeah. They'll blame the algorithms in there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Won't be as much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. Hopefully it doesn't go that route. I like the element that sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes the officiators.
So we are. And you know what? I will tell you this. We do make mistakes. And when I was younger, and as a referee, I'm the crew chief. By the way, what is the, how many referees on a football field?
I don't know the answer to that.
This is great. You can win beer on this all the time. There's only one. It's the one with the white hat. The one that says I'm holding 76 offense. That's a 10-yard penalty from the spot of the foul, right? There's only one. So okay. I was the referee my last 24 years. So I was the crew chief, which means when my crew did something wrong, it's all my fault. Always. No matter who threw the flag, it's 70 yards downfield. They're yelling at me. The point is that I would go over to coach. And when I was a young official, I would argue. Then I got to a point where I'd say, coach would be screaming at me. And I'd say, you know, coach, maybe we didn't get a look at that, but we're going to work really hard to make sure we get the rest of them right. And the coach would be in mid-scream and they'd stop because I'm not arguing. I'm like, okay, you know, we're going to bear down and try to do better. And they just walk away. So
And a lot came out of it. So, So I'd love to hear, what do you think are key attributes or habits that contributed most to your success?
I'm horribly stubborn. I was told, you know, I got told over and over and over and over again from the time I was 17 that I would never be a sportscaster because I was a woman. Never. And my teachers, my family, my college professors, people that I met later on said, this is simply not going to happen in your lifetime. And I'm one of those people that if you tell me no, I'll tell you yes. I will. And, you know, part of that is I wasn't the smartest kid in school. I found out in my 50s I'm dyslexic, which explains a lot of things. I came from a very smart family. Everybody read. I didn't want to read ever. And I remember when I got accepted to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, which is a really smart school. I still think it was a mistake. Someone didn't get in because I did. And my brother, who was 2 years older, walked into my room. I'm packing to go to college. And he's leaning in on the door jamb. He goes, I'm going to make you a bet. He said, you'll flunk out by Christmas. You're too stupid to be in college.
Wow.
Now, I'm telling you, I would have rather been hit by a truck than flunked out of college.
Yeah.
And is it mean of me that I have more degrees than my brother today on my wall? it's probably good that people said no to me because that, you know, as I was growing up, because you know, as I moved into officiating and moved into being a sportscaster, people said no to me all the time. And I'm like, oh, I've heard that before. No, I'll prove you wrong. And honestly, I really think no is a gift. Mm-hmm. No is a gift for some people. I think we need to look at it like that. It's like criticism is a gift. Take it, learn something from it, and figure out a way to make things happen. And I did.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about your book that you sent me. Thank you for sending me that, Your Forgotten Sons. And I had a chance to read it.
Thank you.
It's inspired by a true story.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the real events that sparked this novel?
Yes. I have one of my dearest friends, who's a woman I met at my first TV station in Columbus, Georgia. She was the newsroom assistant. And we've been friends for 40 years. And a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, she called me up and she said, I need your help. I have to have a very delicate surgery and I'm going to be in Johns Hopkins Hospital. I need you to come and be my healthcare power of attorney. And I said, of course. So I flew from Phoenix to Baltimore. She went from Georgia to Baltimore and she had a tumor wrapped around her spinal cord. And there was some question about whether she would walk again. They were concerned she would be paralyzed from the waist down. And that's a horrible thing to face. And so the night before her surgery, she hands me this plastic bag full of 75-year-old letters. And she said, no matter what happens to me, I want you to tell Bud's story. And Bud was her uncle. And even though she's pretty young to have an uncle that was in World War II, her mother had children over 20 years. So Bud was her uncle. And Bud was a man who served in the Graves Registration Service, which is a part of the military that nobody talks about. These are the guys that locate, identify, and bury the dead. Now think about that. So I followed Bud's letters. I followed the postmarks on his letters and the dates. And I trailed him to D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. He was with Patton in Czechoslovakia. And his job, I mean, if you've ever been to Normandy or seen pictures of Normandy, there's a beautiful, graceful cemetery there. Bud and his men built that. The United States has American cemeteries of our war dead in 26 different countries in the world. And our Graves Registration Service people built that. And, you know, you read books about World War II, you see films about World War II, we see great battles and tanks and planes, but we don't see what happens when the battle is over. We always go to another scene or turn the page. Well, what happens is the Graves Registration Service in World War II, those men had to go pick up all the pieces. And this is something nobody likes to talk about. And I read Bud's letters and I watched how he changed. And even though he didn't talk about what he did, in fact, the Graves Registration men were very embarrassed by what they did. They didn't feel like they were real soldiers, which is very sad. But I could see how he changed. And the reason the book is called Your Forgotten Sons is because the last letter home to his mother, Bud signed it, Your Forgotten Son. And we, Regina and I, decided that all those men were forgotten and that we would dedicate, and I've dedicated the book to all the men who served in the Graves Registration Service in World War II. Today, by the way, it's called the Mortuary Division, and we still have it. But today, if a soldier dies in battle, they're shipped home immediately. I mean, they're home in, I don't know, 48 hours. But during World War II, that simply wasn't possible because of the... And remember, too, it wasn't just soldiers they were burying. And it wasn't just American soldiers. When Bud hit the beaches on D-Day, there were 10,000 dead, both Allies and Germans. They all had to be buried because you couldn't... We funneled 186,000 Allied service people through the beaches of Normandy. You can't have bodies lying around. It first of all, it's unhealthy. Secondly, it destroys morale. So they had to constantly be cleaning up the mess of war. And, you know, I wanted the men to know that they've been remembered because quite honestly, I've never read anything about them before, except in one book. And this book was written by Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Schaumann, who was 18 months in the Graves Registration Service during World War II, and he wrote a nonfiction book called Crosses in the Wind. Without that book, I could not have written Your Forgotten Sons simply because I didn't truly understand what their lives looked like. But his book allowed me to see the true horrors of what they went through. And so the book is inspired by a true story, which means based on a true story means we have all the facts. We know who they talked to. We know who their friends were. I didn't know that. Quite a bit of it is fictional because I didn't know all the characters. I had to make some up. But I used Schaumann's situations that his men were in and put Bud in those same situations.
Yeah. No, it's great. Great story. And I got to say, going into it, when you were describing the whole pitchfork things and stuff like that, yeah. I was really thinking I was going to be like cringe the whole time because it is something you don't hear about anywhere, right?
Of course not. Because the military doesn't want to talk about it either.
No. I thought I was going to be cringing during the book, but I was not. It was an engaging story. It was
There's
love story in there and stuff. And so you in the book, you explore loss and duty and the lasting impact of war. So you have all these heavy themes, but you also balance it with hope and resilience. Can you kind of walk us through how you do that?
You know, I don't know. I have to say, I have written 9 books, 6 are published. And this was the most difficult book I've ever written simply because of the themes in it. And it's based on a real human being. And this summer, I went to Indiana where Bud was from. He's from Vincennes, and we had a memorial service for him. 21 gun salute, mayor proclamation, 20 of his family members came and I got to meet them. But here's the thing, not all of them were happy with what I wrote. You know, he's a real man. And there were a couple people that were like, well, how can you say that? I said, look, it's a work of fiction. It's based on, I mean, it's inspired by Bud's life. And so it's difficult when I have all my other characters are fictional. I can do whatever I want with them. But when you're writing about a real person that has family, that's a little different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was an amazing book. Were there any surprises, the surprise discoveries that you made while researching and in the writing process? I know it was during COVID as well, right?
Yes. My plan was to go to France, to go to Europe and follow in Bud's footsteps. And it was difficult because I didn't have his military records. In 1973, the military records depository in St. Louis burned to the ground. And 80% of all the Army's records alone of people who were discharged between, I think, 1918 and 1963 or something were destroyed, Bud's among them. So I didn't have as a reporter, I wanted his records, but I had no access to them. So again, I went off those postmarks on his letters that had dates and postmarks. So I was going to follow them around. And then COVID hit and I was like, damn, what am I supposed to do now? And I wasn't going to write it because as a reporter, when I stopped being a sports reporter, I went into print. And so I wrote about other things besides sports. And so I want to go be where the stories are. I want to see and smell and hear and taste a story. And I couldn't do that. And then I was so silly. I remembered when I was a junior in college, I went to school in Luxembourg. And most of my area of study was World War II. So I do have a background in this area. And I realized I have such fabulous memories of Luxembourg that I put him there. And that was supposed to be fictional. Well, once the book went to print, Regina contacted me and she sent me an obituary that had run in his town paper when he died. And it said he'd been in Luxembourg. Wow. And I went, oh, well, that was nice. So there's a magnificent cemetery in Luxembourg and Patton is buried there. I don't know if you know that. And he probably built that one too with his men.
Yeah. Well, I gotta tell you, it was an incredible story. Shows you a part of the war that you don't often get to see.
No.
You got to see things that were occurring. I don't want to give away too much during World War II back home that influenced the soldiers' lives over there. And you really got a chance to see the horrors, the ups, the downs, all of it from the life of the soldiers, right? And it was just an incredible story. And I think you did a really good job.
Thank you.
Showing it from their eyes without making it too unbearable to get through.
And, I had other stories I could have written about. I'd taken him into Czechoslovakia and I just went, no, there's enough there to tell the story. And I did actually get to write about a baseball game. People always are surprised that my novels, I don't write about sports at all. Bud loved to play baseball. He was put in a reform school as a young man. He was kind of a bad little boy, not bad young man, but he was handsome and charming and the girls loved him. And he was, he was just gregarious and fun before he went to war. And he loved to play baseball. So I took that and I wrote about them playing baseball, the soldiers playing, because they did sometimes.
Was there truth to the logging and stuff like that he was doing before?
He did work for the paper mills. That's why he was so much older. He wasn't drafted until he was 28. Hmm. And that was because he worked in an industry that was needed for the war effort. My own father did the same thing. My dad worked for Westinghouse. And so he got deferred for a while because Westinghouse made war stuff they needed for war. The paper mills in Michigan, it was the same way. So Bud was 28 years old before he went, which is why I sense he got bumped up to sergeant before he ever, when he was in boot camp, I think because he was so much older than everybody else. I mean, that 10 years difference between him and most of the kids made him like a different generation.
Oh, sure.
So I sensed he was the one that kind of took care of the rest of the soldiers that were with him. And he did. Now I don't know that he was a logger, but he probably was. That's how you started out. You know, you got those dangerous jobs being a river pig, which meant they were the guys on the logs, pushing the logs down the river. Horribly dangerous job.
Yeah.
But, you know, he worked there for quite a while. So I'm assuming he did quite a number of jobs working for the paper mills and being a logger.
Yeah. And being from Michigan, it was great hearing that connection here to Michigan and here in the areas that you're at. So
I was born in Grand Rapids.
Oh, were you really? I didn't know that.
But I didn't live there. I moved when I was two. I'm really a Jersey girl. Sorry, I grew up in New Jersey.
So can you tell our audience, for people that are interested in purchasing the book, where do they find it? How do they keep in touch with what you have going on?
They can buy the book anywhere. It's wherever books are sold. My website is AnnMontgomeryWriter.com, and all the links are on there. And that's Ann with an E.
Outstanding. And any future projects, any sneak peek that our audience can hear? What do you got working on? What do you got in the works?
I must admit that I'm taking a little break.
All right.
I have been promoting Your Forgotten Sons for about 14 months now. It's like having a baby.
Yeah.
You have the baby and you don't have another baby right away because you got to take care of the first baby. So there's been a lot. I just got back from a tour in Georgia. And over the summer had one in Indiana, and we've done a lot of promotions for it. And I think I'm going to take a little break and just be happy. I write an article every week. I blog every week. And that's the reporter in me that likes to tell stories. So I do that. I've started a couple things and I just have left them alone.
Yeah.
But I'm sure I'll find something else. If you have a good idea for me, let me know.
Say, right.
Here's a good idea for a story. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Ann, for joining us today and sharing your incredible journey and wisdom. I appreciate your time today, and I want to thank the audience for listening in, and we'll see you next time on the Successes Podcast.
Thank you for having me.